on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
If you look at the work of shamans and seers, you know, they've been talking about since like, well, strongly since the 70s, but like really earlier, talking about how in losing contact with the natural world, we're also losing contact with our souls. And so in my work, a lot of times the easiest access point for people to start to consciously interact spiritually again is through nature. It's kind of the easiest gateway for a lot of people. But in terms of if we're talking about kind of the deep sort of alchemy of the body, we're talking about how we have lost contact with this sort of wildness within, with our intuition, with our instincts, with kind of the parts of ourselves that want to, you know, destroy, create, you know, react, all of these sort of things. And in losing contact with those or trying to stuff them into a box, we have experienced a lot of soul loss. You know, we aren't in contact with our souls, with spirit as much as we were.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, author, teacher, and spiritual healer Mary Mueller-Schutan joins me to discuss her book, Shadow Work for the Soul, Seeing Beauty in the Dark. Mary discusses the individual and collective shadow, shadows of light, the body and shadow work, encountering the shadow through social media, and how the more able you are to go into the shadow, the more light you become. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Mary Mueller-Schutan is a spiritual healer and teacher with an extensive background in Chinese medicine, energy work, and somatic body work. She is the author of several books, including The Spiritual Awakening Guide, Managing Psychic Abilities, The Body Deva, and Working with Kundalini. She joins me today to discuss her latest book, Shadow Work for the Soul. Mary, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, of course. I always like to speak to people who are writing about shadow work and practicing shadow work. I think it's a very crucial activity right now. We have to address our shadows. But that said, I had a listener mentioned to me once a few months back. I forget who I was speaking with in the interview, but we started talking about shadow work. And my listener is like, I didn't know what that was, because my assumption was everyone knows what shadow work is. So I thought that this would be the best place to begin, just to make it clear for anyone watching or listening. What is the shadow and what is shadow work?
Yeah, great questions to start with. So the best way to start talking about the shadow is that it's the parts of ourselves that we're not in contact with or we're not aware of yet. And in terms of shadow work, it's really the purpose of it is coming into contact with our wholeness. So a lot of people look at it as coming into contact with our dark side, like sitting with stuff like anger and, you know, stuff like that. That certainly is part of it. But it's really looking at our reactions to other people, looking at how we are able to sit with and feel our emotions, developing emotional intelligence, and being able to look at how we sort of constricted ourselves or put ourselves into a sort of box, and then, like, you know, breaking out of that box, essentially.
Okay. So breaking out of this box is the end goal. Is that the main purpose of shadow work? You know, what is the benefit to doing this?
There are a lot of benefits to doing shadow work. At first, for a lot of people, it is gaining emotional intelligence, and that is the ability to feel your emotions, to be able to sit with them, to feel like your emotions are no longer this scary thing that have control over you. You have control over them. So that's a big part at first for people. And in my book, I go over a lot of skills on how to get to that place. The second big part of shadow work is looking out at the world and looking at other people and seeing our reactions to them. What we see in others, if we have the appropriate tools to do so, what we can do is sort of take back that energy and consider that we might be projecting our shadow onto others. And so, if we're able to look at others and to see our reactions to them, and those reactions might be irritability, anger, or they might be things like envy. If we're able to look at those reactions and really start to take that energy back, use that as a tool to look within ourselves, what happens is that we'll start to see the parts of ourselves that we've sort of disowned or projected onto others. And the end result of this is feeling emotionally healthier, more stable, being less reactive to others, more compassionate towards others. But really, the ultimate goal of shadow work is to come into contact with a sense of self, which is who we are in our wholeness. So that's kind of the end goal, the end purpose of all of this.
Yeah, to be whole. One of the things, I have a little bit of a background with this. I'm pretty familiar with Carl Jung, and I think he's the one who really wrote about the shadow at first, although others have kind of run with it. And I always thought of the shadow as being all the negative stuff, the things about ourselves that we don't like. But what I was really interested with, and I think that you may be the first person or the first author that I saw or read that addressed this, but you spoke about shadows of light.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was wondering if you could maybe say something about that. What is a shadow of light?
Yeah. So you're right. Shadow work has been popularized as the negative aspects we've kind of denied in ourselves and pushed outwards in a lot of cases. But we also have these shadows of light. So if we consider the shadow to be everything that we don't have access to within ourselves, everything we haven't embodied, what that means is that we also deny within ourselves our own light, our own genius, our own capacities, our abilities, our charisma. And what we tend to do with these shadows is to project them onto celebrities. So project them onto people in the media, also project them onto, friends. I'm sure, with social media and everything like that, these shadows of light are really pervasive because we could log in and see some, woman acting out the perfect family or, somebody with the perfect vacation with their toes in the sand. And we can feel envious about that because we don't have access to that or we're sort of disowning qualities within ourselves that we could stand to take back. So that is also shadow work, is noticing how we've stopped ourselves from accessing our own light, our own power, our own capacities.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I want to apologize. I don't know why, but a fire alarm was just going off here.
Okay.
So,
You're fine. I'm very much a go with the flow sort of person. So, if you run away screaming, I might, like have a question, but I don't.
I don't anticipate doing that, but yeah, and I don't know what was causing that. My friend that I live with, I think, took care of it. Sometimes I've noticed the if we burn copal incense, for some reason that sets off the fire alarms, but I'm not doing that right now.
Okay.
So anyway, yeah, I mean, with what you were just saying, I have found this myself in that it's you get wrapped up in these, not doing the shadow work seems to create a kind of self-imposed prison in some aspects, I think. And it's really difficult to start doing that work and difficult to start seeing how to free ourselves
of this. And we can't ever be free of the shadow. There's always going to be a shadow, right?
We can get to a point where our shadow is fully integrated. Yeah. Does that take some effort? Sure. Is it possible? Yes.
And we often have as well, not just the individual shadow, but there are collective shadows.
So I talk about this in the book as well. And so if we consider that individually, we each have a shadow, we each are projecting out our sort of disowned, unclaimed parts of self, rejected parts of self into the world. What happens is that your neighbor and your friend and your community and the world, each person who's doing that is creating this collective shadow. So if we can think about all of our, unfelt anger going out into the collective, all of our unfelt fear going out into the collective, that can be a wonderful way to understand and really begin to see reality and what's going on with it in a way that can be really helpful to make sense of troubling times and can also help for us to see reality in such a way in that we don't get sort of enmeshed with it. Like, it's really easy to get sort of taken away with collective energies. Like, for example, fear right now is a big one. It's quite easy for us to feel like we're drowning in that or to just, get really engaged with things like hatred or envy, any of the really strong emotions right now. And so, shadow work, if we're able to see these collective shadows, we're able to not only do our individual work to sort of take back what we individually are putting out there, but we also can sort of have an observer perspective of what's going on with reality so we don't get so sort of torn down and kind of abused by it in a way.
The collective shadows, I think, can be kind of frightening in some aspects. I think, the example that I always use just for a shadow is like the schoolyard bully. And who do they pick on? They always pick on the weak link. And so it's their self-perception of being weak that they're, and this is a term that we'll get into, they project it onto the other person. And you can see that collectively, who is the society projecting onto? And I think a good example of that was, Nazi Germany, where they were projecting onto the Jewish community and others as well. But along with this, I think there are a lot of questions with that is how do we address a collective shadow? How do we, in our culture, how would we stop doing that? How do we work with this fear that we are seeing currently?
Yeah, the first thing is to see it clearly. That's always, the first thing in solving any issue, healing any issue. If we're going back to Jung, he was talking about, he always said that anybody doing their own shadow work was doing a big part for the collective and societal problems of our day. And so, I do think that sometimes people get really overwhelmed by collective shadows because there's not much we can do about a huge shadow of fear that's created about millions of people. What we can do is to have the correct perspective on it, to do our own work in regards to it, and to deeply feel and have empathy for whatever is going on. We should be shocked, horrified, feel anger, upset, grief at some of the events in our world. And a lot of times we stop ourselves from going there, which is understandable. But with the correct tools, we can let ourselves feel these things. We can stop contributing to the collective. And we can also sort of get out of our own stuff enough to be able to do things like volunteer locally, to be a listening ear to somebody else who, is still kind of in the swamps of the collective. So doing our own work helps energetically, but what it also does is it frees up energy in ourselves to be of service in some capacity.
Okay. Yeah, the approach that I try to take is, this is just my own personal example, is a specific politician who I kind of loathe. And a lot of people are like, oh yes, I hate this person. And what I started doing is I would say, okay, but in what way, what are the things about this person that I dislike? And how do I present those? So for example, I don't like their arrogance. Well, in what ways am I arrogant? So I'm always trying to kind of take it back and reflect on myself. Is that a, I hope that that's a healthy approach of dealing with a collective shadow.
It is. That is a great way of looking at our individual shadow. If you're talking about, for example, and if you come across an arrogant politician or an arrogant colleague, and that person truly, irritates you, bothers you, you feel like, you're reactive to them, looking at in what ways am I arrogant can be a good place to take back that shadow. Another one starting out for people is that they may be reactive to an arrogant individual because that isn't a part of them yet. It's something that's been cut off from them. So they may actually need to come into contact with a type of healthy arrogance within themselves.
Okay.
So that's, kind of part of shadow work tools as well. If we're talking about collective shadows, figures like celebrities, politicians, social media personalities, there is a reason why people become popularized. And so we can look at them as individual people and see our reaction to them, but we can also take a step back, and this is like kind of advanced work, but we can take a step back and consider how the energies of hundreds, thousands, millions of people have gone in to sort of create this person. Yes, they are a person in their own right, but there's a reason why this social media personality or politician has sort of emerged, come into being in this particular time, in this particular place. And if we're able to look at that perspective, we can see a lot of societal wounding, a lot of societal sickness, and from that perspective, we can have a lot of understanding, which is really healing.
Yeah. And does it have to be another person? And what's driving this question is one of my main concerns is the current state of our environment, the many ecological crises that we face. And you wrote in the book, it's a part of the old Hermetic axiom of as above, so below, but it's as within, so without. And it seems like that, that's crucial in terms of shadow work. So can we recognize aspects of the shadow in other areas that aren't, another person?
Of course. Yeah. So typically where people start is with shadow work is like, oh, that person bothers me. Why? But if we go to a deeper level, as within, so without, we can start, properly mourning, first of all, feeling what's going on with the environment. And we can also question from a spiritual, energetic perspective of why this is happening. Obviously, we can consider a lot of, physical stuff going on, but on a spiritual, energetic level, the environment, for example, very much has to do energetically with the physical body. And so, us being out of touch with our physical bodies, with our physical forms, that mirrors in the destruction in the environment. So the more online we get, the more, kids don't go outside to play, the more, disassociated we become, we can see that mirrored in the environment as well. So, yeah.
I'm trying to find the quote here. I wanted to ask you about the body because, and this is probably a paraphrase, but I, you at one point you say that or wrote that the body is the present moment. Our bodies are the present moment. And there were some other things here about the body, but let's just start with there, because what is this importance of the body? Is the body in some aspects part of the shadow?
It is. If we look at the deeper aspects of shadow work, what happens when you take back your shadow is that these sort of primal instincts come up. So, our instinctual sort of animalist, and a lot of people are afraid of these aspects of ourselves because they're kind of wordless. They're kind of the primitive wild aspects of ourselves that remain. But these are the parts of self where all of our power is. And if we start to really make contact with our shadow in an embodied way, meaning we've taken it back from the world and all the people out there, what happens is that we can regain this power. We can regain sort of the creativity that comes with it. We can sort of feel this wildness within. So this wildness often expresses best through nonverbal things, dancing, feeling, intuition, painting, creativity, all of that sort of stuff. So in terms of my understanding of the body is that there are quite a few different maps of consciousness. I've always been interested in consciousness. That has been kind of one of my, main interests. And what I found was that if we awaken through the body, if we become more conscious through the body, which involves things like feeling, healing past trauma, physically taking care of the physical form, is that that has much different and more powerful results than simply working with the contents of the mind. And so awakening through the body, doing work in an embodied way, what that means is that we have the opportunity to awaken all aspects of ourselves. And in terms of shadow work, what happens is that we awaken so much like vibrancy, power, that is all stored within our human form. So I kind of went on there. I could probably talk about this for days, but we don't resolve emotions and past feelings fully, past nervous system responses, fight or flight, and all the rest of them, unless we do it through the body. And so that is why doing this work is so important through the body in an embodied feeling way, because otherwise we may gain mental awareness of something, but our reality won't change. How we feel about ourselves and others doesn't change. So that's why I'm on, a huge yay body kick. Yeah.
Well, no, that's good. And we can hang out here for a little bit, because I think that especially in the West, there is this division between body and soul. And the quote I was looking for, you wrote that being fully in our bodies brings us into full contact with our souls. And most people don't think that the soul is that there is this division between body and soul.
I would say I don't believe that there is a division, but if we are talking about how to get people to a place where they can access their souls, it is not through the mind, it's through the body, it's through feeling, it's through, doing work with the body through the body.
Well, and it's also the case that we hold these emotions and traumas within our bodies. So it makes sense to me that that's the place where we would begin, that if we ignore the body, we are ignoring something crucially important, especially since we're embodied beings.
Yeah, exactly. So one of my previous books was called The Body Deva, and it's basically working with the consciousness of the body. So it's going in with the understanding that our body is kind of a storehouse for the emotions and traumas we have yet to process. And what happens is that if you learn to kind of speak to the body consciousness, is that, first of all, it often gives much different answers than the mind gives, and it heals the trauma and emotions that are stored in a much different way than work that is done on an intellectual level. So I have people come to me that have been, therapists for decades and that sort of stuff. I personally have benefited from good therapy, but it is almost, I talk about this later in the shadow work book as well. Like it is almost impossible to heal the nervous system responses due to stress and trauma that we've experienced unless we involve the body as part of our healing path.
Yeah, and the body gets back to what I was saying earlier about our ecological crises is that there's a connection between our environment and our bodies. And when you talk about wildness, what immediately comes into my mind is Thoreau, who wrote that in wildness is the preservation of the world.
Great quote. I would very much agree. We really have an epidemic of this going on right now. It has been going on for decades. If you look at the work of shamans and seers, they've been talking about since like, well, strongly since the 70s, but like really earlier, talking about how in losing contact with the natural world, we're also losing contact with our souls. And so, in my work, a lot of times the easiest access point for people to start to consciously interact spiritually again is through nature. It's kind of the easiest gateway for a lot of people. But in terms of if we're talking about kind of the deep sort of alchemy of the body, we're talking about how we have lost contact with this sort of wildness within, with our intuition, with our instincts, with kind of the parts of ourselves that want to, destroy, create, react, all of these sort of things. And in losing contact with those or trying to stuff them into a box, we have experienced a lot of soul loss. We aren't in contact with our souls, with spirit as much as we were.
And I think that that is incredibly important to reconnect to our spirit and ground it in the physical world and in the body. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is, and this is a big jump probably, but it's the idea of spiritual bypassing. And I was wondering if you could maybe say what that is and how does that relate to the shadow?
Yeah, so hopefully I don't screw up his name, but it was a term created by John Wellwood, who was a psychotherapist. I believe he was a psychologist who noticed that he was getting people into his practice who had meditated for long periods of time, but they were still experiencing a lot of difficulties, emotional, energetic, spiritual sort of difficulties. And so the term spiritual bypass came about from him. And basically, what it means is that it is quite easy to use spirituality to look away from our issues rather than look towards our issues. And so, this is pretty pervasive. We are sort of meaning-making creatures, and, we can sort of grasp onto spirituality to create meaning for ourselves, to distract ourselves away from what might be physical, emotional, spiritual problems or, trauma and that sort of stuff. A good example of this, for example, is that I saw a post the other day and it's like, you are an old soul if you, react badly in social situations, you get nervous when you hear loud sounds. And it was this whole list basically describing what would now be known as CPTSD, so complex post-traumatic stress syndrome. And so it would be really appealing for somebody to think that they're an old soul rather than for them to think that maybe they have some childhood trauma that they could stand to heal. So with shadow work, one of the reasons that it works so well is that we create all of these layers of meaning, all of these defenses, and we push out or project all of the stuff that we don't want to know or see about ourselves onto other people and onto the world. And so we have these huge blind spots, and then we wonder why we're, surrounded by idiots or, something like that. And so for people who are willing, there's shadow work where we can look directly at other people and the world and question our reactivity and see these big blind spots. And by doing that, we're cutting through our tendencies towards escapism, towards looking beyond our problems, to over-spiritualizing, to, our ego does all of these funky things in an attempt to try to protect ourselves. We can kind of cut through all of that sort of stuff with shadow work when, when we follow and do it correctly. So that is how spiritual bypass relates to the shadow, is that we can look at those, kind of blinders that we put on in the areas where, we're trying to pretend to be superior or feel inferior or whatever is going on with us. We can directly look at that and, look at our spiritual bypassing.
Okay. Well, when you mentioned the defense aspect to it, what immediately came to mind was the ego. And you noted several different sort of defenses in the ego. And I think that one of the things that is important, I'm glad that you wrote this, is that the ego is not bad. I think often the ego gets a really bad rap. And I've been guilty of, saying, oh, yeah, the ego is not any good. And I always refer to, I saw someone at the gym once that had a t-shirt that read, your ego is not your amigo. But it kind of is in some aspects because it helps us set boundaries, right?
It does. The best way to think about the ego is really it's our identity, it's our conceptualization of self. And what happens is that we experience some type of pain, rejection, trauma, abandonment. We're hurt in some capacity. And so what happens on a psychological and energetic level is that our ego kind of says, oh, I don't want that to happen again. Let me defend against that. And so it will start to set up, barriers to doing that. And part of that is kind of thinking about ourselves differently. For example, one of the things that there are a lot of different ego defenses that we can have, but one of the things that happens most often that I talk about in the book is I call it the superiority inferiority loop. And what that basically is that in some way we're made to feel inferior, worthless, bad. And so we create this ego defense that, we're special, we're too good for the world, we're better than all of them, that sort of thing. And so, if you are able to look at the ego as a defense against pain, we can start to have a lot more compassion for it and really understand why people are the way that they are, instead of being like, oh, you should get rid of the ego. It's like, no, we should have a healthy ego. We should have a healthy sense of self. We should have a healthy, flexible ego that when we heal changes and shifts, and we should have a sense of self.
Yeah. And the ego is different than our personas because you talk about the masks that we wear, and we have all these different personas. And I was wondering, how do we differentiate between the masking that we do and our ego and a healthy ego?
Yeah, good question. So we can look at the ego's defense as creating a sort of wall around the trauma that we've experienced. And one of the tools of the ego can be to utilize a persona, utilize a mask. So we feel, let's say I work with, a lot of people who experience imposter syndrome. They feel like no matter what, they're not good enough, all of the, no matter what they're doing, like they kind of feel like a fraud. And so some people, are willing to heal that, and others put up that ego barrier around themselves, and then they may put on a persona of being completely competent, superior to everyone around them. And so the ego and persona often work together in order to defend and present to the world something that we feel like may be more appealing or acceptable to the people around us.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. That's very helpful. And something else I came to mind when you were speaking a little bit ago is you've got this quote in the book that it's now considered normal in our culture to be in a trance-like state, continually distracted and unable to concentrate on anything but for a short period of time. And I'm curious about this being in a trance-like state. Is that an aspect of, is it a, I don't know if it's a spiritual bypassing, but what's going on there? What do you think is happening there?
In some regards, it has to do with our previous discussion regarding separation from nature. When we
Okay.
are in contact with bodies and in contact with the world, we're more present. The huge factor that has been over like the last 10, 15 years is, social media, appearance of TikTok, YouTube shorts, all of that sort of stuff where, I mean, it's, I hate to be one of those like, the kids today sort of thing, but they
Yeah.
really have done studies where we have this sort of, experience of stolen focus going on where kids aren't able to sit for anything other than because they're used to, 15 second, things, couple minute things on YouTube, on TikTok and that sort of stuff. And so what is happening is that our brains literally rewire around that. And so when we have brains that rewire around being online all the time, on having these little bits of information around the information overload that we experience, a lot of the crisis in terms of mental health, for example, is that we can turn on, Reddit or the news or something like that and just get this onslaught of information. And so with social media and particularly social media being so focused on offering us this huge amount of information, but in very, very small bite size sort of pieces of information, our brains are burned out. They are used to not focusing, not paying attention, and we're going away from things like learning, When I was in school, but when I was in school, I had to, memorize poems and, memorize stuff like that. And all of that sort of stuff is, old methods of learning how to study, learning how to really absorb and take in information. And it's so easy for us in this day and age to just hop from thing to thing. And that's really having an impact not only on our brains, but also kind of, on our emotional intelligence, how we interact with ourselves and others.
Yeah, I had over Christmas, I always spend Christmas with my brother and his family. And I was speaking with my niece, who's a senior in high school, and she has an interest in psychology. And I was trying to explain to her what the shadow is. And I remember I was like, maybe had been talking for like maybe just like 1 minute. And she's like, "Why are you rambling?" And I'm like, "I'm not. I'm a college professor, and I also see it there." But I immediately thought, yeah, it's the attention span is kind of gone. And that's really problematic. And I don't think it's just the youth. I don't think it's just the
It
youth.
isn't. I know plenty of adults who, are on their phones looking at Instagram and also
Yeah.
watching TV at the same time and also cooking dinner and, somehow at the same
Yeah.
time. So it isn't. But one of the things that we can do looking at collective shadows is really look towards generational differences. And so, my nephews who don't watch movies really, they just look at their iPads like, yeah, that's a different reality than the one I grew up in or the one that my parents or grandparents grew up in.
And I am thinking about in regards to the social media and our technologies, a couple of things. One is, I know it's been posited before that what happens is we end up in this sort of narcissistic stupor, kind of looking at ourselves. But at the same time, I had a guest on recently who commented that our devices are literally black mirrors. Because when I look at my phone, I can see myself. And I'm trying in my brain right now to make a connection between the social media aspect that is kind of narcissistic, but also how we're reflected back to ourselves in this sort of black mirror, because you wrote that, the world is a mirror.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. First of all, in terms of narcissism, I would agree that social media certainly has sort of catapulted our narcissistic instincts. If you look towards reality TV, we are celebrating narcissism. And so one of the things to really understand about the shadow is that it shows us the aspects of ourselves that we are not ready to claim yet. And so there's a reason why, everybody's, narcissism is kind of the word of the past couple of years. There's a reason why people are interested in it and also, creating it into this huge bad other, separate from the self, and also celebrating it and glorifying it at the same time. If you look at sites like, for example, Reddit, what Reddit is, even though they might have some nice stuff on there, but it's largely, kind of sharing the worst aspects of humanity. And in reading over that, and looking at that, we're sort of coming into contact with those aspects of ourselves, but in a very removed sort of way. Horror movies have done this fabulously for many decades. We are able to come into contact with some of the horrors of human experience, loss, grief. There's a great movie about dementia that literally the walls were caving in, and the characters that I saw the other day. So, what happens when we view these sort of things is that we are the observers. We can recognize those aspects of humanity, but in having them sort of removed or separate from us, we feel like we have power over them. So, for example, if we talk about true crime and the reason why true crime is so popular, podcasts, Dateline, all of that sort of stuff, it's because we really want to know these aspects of ourselves, but we aren't yet at the point where we can consider them within ourselves. We have to consider them on a screen. So I think that that's sort of the best way to come to terms with like social media and that sort of stuff is that we are coming into contact with our shadows. Can't if we are willing to take back that energy to look at that within, it can be in some regards a great tool.
But doesn't there have to be something that kind of shakes us awake in a sense? Because if we are in a trance-like state, how do you break the trance?
There are a couple of ways that people typically break the trance. The first is, unfortunately, childhood trauma. People who have experienced childhood trauma often have a need to understand the self and understand the world. They've had darkness, sort of the shadow, come into their life too early. And so, they've kind of been broken out of that cocoon that we're supposed to put kids in. The other is where some people come to a point in their lives where they hit rock bottom. They're an addict, or they're just really unhappy with their lives. They're depressed. They're, getting into that sort of nihilistic, nothing matters, nothing's important sort of thing. And they reach a juncture in which essentially there's either a moment of grace or something happens where they're like, I need to do something with my life. I need to figure something out because I can't continue sort of, doing this sort of thing. So those are kind of the more dramatic reasons. Kind of a milder reason is somebody sort of, being at the banks of a shore, and maybe they dip their toes in, and then they start going deeper and deeper, and their sort of curiosity and the results that they're seeing and what they're learning, those sort of guide them to kind of getting to the bottom of the ocean, so to speak.
Yeah, and you use that metaphor quite a bit in the book about the bottom of the ocean. And is that the, in general, the kind of the unconscious? And I think there are like levels to it.
So I will say that I'm a water person in Chinese medicine, which, so I tend to use a lot of water imagery, a lot of water music, that sort of stuff. But in terms of the example in the book, there's been a long history with understanding the water as representing consciousness. And a lot of people understand this just by, feel if they sit by a lake or a body of water, the feeling of calmness that they feel or the ability to self-reflect sort of increases. But if we start to understand ourselves on multiple layers, what we can understand ourselves is as, kind of the surface waves, mid-ocean, and the ocean floor. Surface waves is what we already know about ourselves. Mid-ocean tends to be what happens when we sort of scratch the surface. And the ocean floor is the true reason for things, kind of the root of things, why things sort of came to be. And I specifically offer that tool in this book because a lot of the times when we might look at somebody, the reason for us not liking them or being irritated by them or reacting to them may at first be a surface, wave reason or a mid-ocean reason. But if we're able to sit with it for a bit, we can get to the sort of ocean floor reason, which is, where that sort of shadow lies.
Okay, wonderful. And this is kind of jumping back, and I apologize if I'm bouncing around, but one of the things that I was thinking about here is in terms of spirituality, I see this emphasis placed by a lot of people about being light workers. And often the impression I get with that is that it is a rejection of the shadow, that people don't want to look in the shadow. But isn't it also the case that the brighter the light, the darker the shadow, or the bigger the shadow?
Yeah, I will say that what is popularized regarding light work or regarding, any other form of spiritual psychological work tends to be rooted in a lot of self-denial. So, yes, there are going to be a fair amount of people who turn to spirituality, in general, but especially light work to sort of ignore the dark, So that certainly is a big factor in something that people will run across. One of the things that happens with shadow work is that the more that you're able to feel your emotions, the more that you're able to like venture into that darkness of self, the more light you become. So it's this interesting, sort of dichotomy. It's expressed really well through the yin yang symbol, where you have one side that's dark, one side that's light, but in the dark side there's that, nugget of light, and on the light side there's that darkness. And it expresses one of those, really deep truths, which is to really access your light, to feel it, to be able to emanate it. It takes venturing through your darkness to get there.
No, I like that in order to find the light, we have to go through the darkness. And there's something else I wanted to ask you about because I was glad that you wrote it. And I definitely want to ask you to expand upon this. But one note, and this is a section title, I believe, suffering is not a gift. And I think that that is part of the maybe again, spiritual bypassing and focusing on the light. Often we hear that, your suffering is a gift. There's something good in there for you. But you wrote, no, it's not a gift.
Yeah. Through our suffering, we can definitely learn. We can expand consciousness for sure. Some of the most empathetic people I've met are people who've been through tremendous difficulty. But I have a background working in hospice with ALS, with cancer patients, stuff like that. And when you really sit with reality, there's a tremendous amount of suffering. There are people out there who have cancer and they've done everything right in their lives, and we very much are a culture that denies death. And so one of the ways that we deny death, just a huge aspect of the shadow, is coming to terms and accepting death, is all of these sort of beliefs and sort of understandings of reality that essentially defend us against reality. So if we truly believe that somebody isn't at fault for getting cancer, if somebody doesn't have a big lesson to learn out of being abused or harmed, what that means is that the world is chaotic and we have so much difficulty sitting with the chaos and the randomness of reality. We'd much prefer to blame people for their issues or to kind of tie it up in sort of a bow. And it's like, no, if somebody experiences a lot of childhood abuse, like maybe they've learned some things about reality, but they also have a nervous system that wasn't able to develop properly. They have a nervous system that's basically wrecked that they now have to repair. They don't trust people or don't feel like people like them anymore, So yeah, suffering is not a gift, and it's definitely something that when I was working with like ALS patients that I would hear a lot, and it just made me shake my fists at the time. I get it now, is we defend against what we don't want to know, but yeah.
And it's true that we are a death-denying society, but I always try to keep in mind that death is an ally in many ways, because if you acknowledge your death, then you're probably a little bit less likely to fritter away your time.
Exactly. Not to plug another book, but Alexander Lowen wrote this fabulous book. I think it's called Fear of Life, but he argues that underneath our fear of death is a fear of truly living. And I love that perspective, and I found that to be incredibly true. And I've certainly walked myself, as well as plenty of people, through that recognition, because people get to a point where they're afraid of change, not because of, they have more trauma to deal with or something like that, but they're afraid of change because they might get more energy. They might, they wouldn't know what to do with their lives if they weren't, constantly giving away their energy to others, that sort of stuff. So the other thing that I tell people about death that tends to really help is looking at death as a transition. And we go through a lot of painful transitions in our life, and a lot of them may actually be more painful than physical death is. And when you go through physical death, you don't have to like figure out, who you are after, in the case of divorce or, whatever, trauma or happening you have to like kind of pick up the pieces, so to speak. So that tends to help people with that.
Life seems to be a series of initiations.
I would agree with that.
Something else I wanted to ask you about is something that comes up quite frequently in the book is, and I don't know that you use the phrase inner child, but I think that that's there and it's present. And if I understand correctly, a lot of the defenses that the ego sets up and that then will feed into the shadow are generated as we're children.
Yeah, so what happens when we're a child is that we experience something that we can't make sense of or is too overwhelming for us at the time. And so a part of us sort of energetically gets frozen at that age. And so what then happens is that we set up these ego defenses. For example, if the inner child is experiencing bullying at school, and she feels like nobody likes her and that she doesn't belong. What is she going to do at that age? She's going to set up an ego defense that she's special, that, she's absolutely different from anybody. Maybe she's an alien or, something like that. And all of that is to defend against that inner child who is experiencing pain that it never got to express. A really important part about inner child work that a lot of people don't really understand or doesn't come forward like it should is this understanding that we really can freeze in our development. And so, what that means is that a part of ourselves doesn't go forward through the stages of development. And this affects people so much, There's kind of this cultural like sort of cartoon about, somebody secretly being two toddlers in a trench coat. And,
Yes.
it isn't that far off. There's a reason why, your 50-year-old friend melts down and has a temper tantrum like a toddler. It's because a part of herself is still stuck at that age where she hasn't gotten what she needs. She hasn't been heard or seen properly in a way that has allowed for her to kind of unfreeze and move forward and become more adult.
It's also seems that this would play out collectively as well. I seem to remember, I think it was the actor Simon Pegg got some backlash about making the comment that there's this sort of juvenile aspect to our culture now, where you might see 50-year-olds who have a wonderful collection of Star Wars figures, and that we seem to be stuck in this place of where we haven't gone further, we haven't developed yet.
I will say that the reintroduction of play is really important for adults.
Okay.
So I'll put that there. So not everybody who
Okay.
has a
Yeah.
Star Wars collection is necessarily stagnated. But yeah, so just like we were talking before, like, yeah, there are a lot of people that are stuck in development as infants, as toddlers, as teenagers. And this very much expresses in the world and then different communities. For example, probably going to get backlash about this, but I was a part of the, I guess I wasn't really a part, I was interested in the occult community for many years. It's a different way of looking at energy and working with it. And what I found was a lot of people were stuck in that sort of teenage anti-authoritarian sort of, energy. And there can be other communities where people who are stuck in a particular stage of development tend to gravitate towards one another. And so that group will sort of express that sort of stagnancy rather than, moving into a more adult sort of engaged place. But yeah, from what I've heard about the film industry, it tends to be kind of teenage.
Well, yeah, it often seems like that's the major demographic that our entertainment industry is going towards. And there does seem, it just seems to me that we collectively, and I can only speak to the United States, that we've got some growing up to do. There seems to be a lot of adolescent rebellion that's happening and temper tantrums. So,
Yeah, I would agree with that. When you're able to really sit with kind of people being stuck in stages of development, it does cause for you to see people and, the kind of people we put forward in collective consciousness, celebrities, politicians, all that sort of stuff. It does start to caused for you to view them a bit differently.
Well, and I think that the point, though, is that we all have traumas. We're all traumatized in one way or another. And I think we have individual traumas, we have collective traumas. And something that you wrote, I thought was crucially important. And it was, you wrote, we tend to so readily dismiss our pain because we can point to others who have it worse. And I think that that's really important to not diminish the pain that we've experienced. And just because someone else has it worse doesn't mean that we shouldn't feel the pain that we do.
Yeah, exactly. That is often a hurdle for people where they can say, you know, this person has it worse. Or sometimes people come to me and they say, I have, you know, the things that people should say that I should have in life, but I'm still feeling badly. You know, can we look at that sort of thing? And so we do compare, you know, to kind of trauma contest sort of thing. And we also have this sort of collective ideal that, you know, if we only had enough things, enough money, we should be happy. And we certainly need a basic amount of money to live. But beyond that, you know, a lot of it has to do with emotional work rather than, you know, physically having the right car or whatever our thoughts are.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was just thinking in terms of this idea of the materialism, that if we have all these material goods, then we can be happy. And it seems to me that there's a connection between that kind of materialism, but yet needing to focus on the body. And maybe I'm off track here, but I just find an interesting connection because there's material in both places.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. You know, they have done studies, like I mentioned, that people need a basic income to live because other than that, they have, you know, people have every reason to be miserable, you know. But I have certainly worked with people who are quite wealthy, or I believe there was a speech or interview that Jim Carrey gave a while ago that I read. And, you know, there is this expectation of materialism equaling, you know, being content. And what happens is that people reach a threshold in which they have all the things and they're supposed to be happy, and they aren't. So it is interesting to look at that and even considering, you know, going to the complete opposite end. You know, people who get really wrapped up in minimalism and not having anything, that can be as much of kind of like an ego inflation thing as having, you know, a yacht or something like that. So having a healthy relationship to money, to materialism, I think is really essential. So, but we so tend to go to, you know, kind of opposite ends with things, especially spiritually.
And something I've been thinking about a lot lately is I see a lot of spirituality now being connected to material wealth. And I know there's a history to this going all the way back to our Puritan forefathers, but you know, things like the prosperity gospel, and I see online a lot of like on YouTube, spiritual, quote unquote, spiritual videos are often about manifesting wealth and the life that you want to live. And it seems to me that there might be some kind of shadow aspect at play there as well.
Yeah, what this gets into is the shadow of kind of spiritual communities overall. And you're right, a lot of it is sort of rooted in prosperity gospels. And then we can look at, you know, even some, you know, tantric texts and stuff like that, talking about if you're, you know, kind of flowing overall, that includes money and that sort of stuff. But one of the things, if we look at spirituality from, you know, kind of a more removed perspective, is looking at it as a source of consumerism, like it needs consumers to it. And so what it does really successfully is sort of dangle the carrot just out of reach. And so it often does this by saying, if you're only spiritual enough, if you're only enlightened enough, you will be healthy, wealthy, you know, never have a negative thought in your life. You'll be constantly in a state of bliss. And all of these things are sold to us. And we really, you know, until we get to a certain point, we really desire all of them, which is understandable, but we'll never get there. And that's the whole point of the thing, is to dangle that carrot just out of reach. And so, yeah, people make a massive amount of essentially preying on people's vulnerable points, preying on people's sense of emptiness within. And it's unfortunate, but it is. It also is what it is.
Well, and I'm glad that you brought up that this idea of kind of this promise of, like constant bliss. And I always refer to this as being blissed out. And we can't really exist in that place. We have to, always kind of go back down in a sense. And, I know from a like a Buddhist perspective in terms of awakening. This is actually from a Zen. It was the idea of, well, what do you do, before enlightenment? Well, you chop wood, you carry water. What do you do after enlightenment? Well, you chop wood and you carry water.
Yeah, there are people, you know, like Ramana Maharshi, who, you know, went into that absorption state and just, you know, sat on the hill for the rest of his life. And so sometimes that sounds appealing. I will say that spiritually, there are, you know, absorption states that we can get into where it really is bliss or peace or, you know, some quality that's really wonderful, but we can't really do much in them. And so one of the things that happens is, you know, we get so obsessed with this finish line, which re with reaching the peak of a mountain, and really understanding through shadow work and through other means that spirituality is about accepting and becoming more human, can be really extraordinarily helpful for people, not only to break free from kind of some of the predatory spiritual stuff that we see, but also to recognize things like, hey, we need our emotions. You know, maybe we could stand to connect more to other people. If we don't experience sorrow, how are we going to experience happiness? We need that contrast. So, those sorts of things and more nuanced spirituality and more kind of realistic spirituality are needed for those who aren't looking for that illusion, for that carrot.
Okay. Do you have, I guess I want to ask this. I often ask guests, especially when we're talking about like the ecological crises, I will ask them if they have hope. And I kind of want to ask you if you have hope, not in the sense of an ecological crisis, but in the sense of that we can individually and collectively engage in shadow work and kind of grow up a bit as a culture.
Yeah, I mean, there's always hope there. You know, even right now, you know, the timeline for writing for authors is really interesting. So I actually got my book into the publisher before shadow work started getting popular. So nice synchronicity. But there's a reason why kind of trends or, you know, forms of healing come into the collective in a specific time. And so there's a reason basically why shadow work is so popular right now. And so I do think that there are people who are interested in looking at themselves, who are interested in working and learning how to work with their emotions. There's been this huge trend towards talking about trauma and emotional health. I think that, you know, the pendulum tends to swing a little bit too much when we introduce something like that. But when it sort of comes back, there's a lot of hope for people going forward for learning how to work with their emotions, learning that they can have emotions, learning it's a good thing to have emotions, and all of that is incredibly healing for the collective.
Well, I'm glad that you have hope. And I do find it interesting that shadow work has become so popular. I often have this sense that a lot of the, we can look at sort of the history of like what's been popular in terms of therapies. And, it used to be, it was all Freud, and then it was behaviorism. Then it's, well, just take a pill. And now, it's like cognitive behavioral therapy has been popular for a while. But I have this sense that depth psychology is starting to percolate up into the collective consciousness, as it were.
Yeah, one of the ways I look at reality is, a pendulum swinging, like I just mentioned. And so right now we're in a phase in terms of psychology where it is very, I am scientific. This is, how you retrain your thoughts sort of thing, which again can be enormously helpful for people, all those exercises and stuff like that. But we then tend to have a swing back. And so, yeah, it would be great if depth psychology, if existential work, if narrative therapy, if all of those things would come back. They'll likely come back in another form with somebody else's name, sort of stamped on them. But understanding the cycles of those things, and you're right, it would be great if some of that, really relational psychology would come forward. I love personally Carl Rogers' work. I talk about his work a lot in my book. He's all about unconditional positive regard and, conditional and unconditional worth. And just if people were to understand those basic concepts, it's really the world would change, sort of thing.
And I want to throw in there as well, somatic therapies as well, a return to the
Yeah,
body.
they've been around and popular for a while. I think that they could, what tends to happen when things like body work become more popularized is that this happened with acupuncture as well, is that they kind of turn from a mind body spirit modality to a mind body modality and eventually become like a mind modality. And this is to sort of reach the most amount of people. Yeah, I could give a whole spiel about acupuncture, but basically going back to, of course I'm biased, but going back to inserting the spirit into things, into thinking about meaning and purpose on an individual level, into questioning on a basic level our connection to ourselves, to the world, to the divine, that sort of stuff is very much needed and where I hope our culture will start going.
As well do I, as well do I. So I know we're starting to run out of time here, but I wanted to ask if, I found your book very helpful because you really go into the depths about shadow work. And you have some exercises, but it's not, I see a lot of books that are mostly just like how-tos. And they don't go into quite the depth that your book does. And so I think it's an incredible resource for that. But I was curious if someone is interested in shadow work. We started by, I said, okay, look, I know that some of my listeners don't know what it is. So let's start defining it. So now let's say that this person's intrigued and they're like, okay, this sounds really good. Where would you have them start to engage in a kind of shadow work activity or practice?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is in my book, but there are two places to start. And the first is to start to gain emotional intelligence skills. And those skills really let people feel their emotions, to develop boundaries with them so they're not overwhelming, to recognize that feelings are good, they're just messengers, all of that sort of stuff. That can really help guide people. That's a really important first and, probably second through 20th step, but it's a good place for people to start. In terms of shadow work, the other thing to start doing would be to start looking at our reactions to other people. Sometimes people truly are just like, jerks or whatever our thoughts are regarding them, but what happens is that if we keep on meeting the same person or, in different faces, if we keep on having the same reactions to people, then that's something to, kind of look at. And so people can really start there, looking at their reactions to people. Do you think all people are idiots? Do you think all people are crazy? Do you think all people are much smarter than you? Whatever your reaction is that you notice yourself having, kind of not just once, is a good place to start. Awareness is Always a great way to start.
Yeah, excellent. And I was curious, as you were speaking, I noted down, I wrote down the word overwhelm. And I did that because it seems to me, and I don't know if I'm right on this, is that a lot of people feel overwhelmed. And it seems like a lot of that overwhelm is with the emotions that we don't know how to process them. And it seems like we're kind of shutting them off, and then we still feel that sort of overwhelm. And I don't.
A great way to think about it is that, for example, if we never learn to deal with our anger, every time we feel angry, it's sort of like something we shove into the closet. And so when we try to work with our anger, it's like opening that closet door and everything tumbles out. It's just too much for us. And so we can develop skills like titration, like developing boundaries with ourselves where we feel a small amount of that, where we take one thing out of the closet instead of, letting everything sort of fall out. Those are important skills to have because you're right. If we haven't dealt with our panic for long periods of time, a floodgate can open and that's not really helpful. But what might be helpful is working with a small corner of that.
And just sitting with the emotions for a little bit and allowing yourself to feel them, right?
I go over that in my book, but it seems like such a simple thing. But again, like people asking you what shadow work is, people, I've had students, come to me and be like, what does really sitting with your emotions mean? How do I do that? And so going over those things in my book of how to, take 10 minutes out of your day and sit with your emotions and the steps to really go through that can really help people, no matter where they are with things to really gain those tools and to understand them in a deep way.
Well, again, I think your book is going to be very helpful to a lot of people. And it was very interesting. I'm glad I had the opportunity to read it. I'm glad I had the opportunity to speak with you about it. But let me ask, what do you have coming up?
Yeah, so you can go to my website, maryshutan.com, and you can see my teaching schedule coming up. This is my latest book, but I have eight other books, so there's a treasure trove of information for people who haven't heard of me before, or maybe have only, read one of my books. So I really focus a lot of my time on teaching, and so you can find that at my website. I'm also on Facebook and Instagram, a little bit begrudgingly, but it's a good place to connect with people and, to share what I'm thinking and what's coming up for me and all that good stuff as well.
Well, social media serves a function, I think.
It does. It's been wonderful to connect with people, and to interact with people in a different way. So it's definitely not all bad. I just, I'm not really like a selfies kind of person. So it's been interesting for me.
I had someone review what I've been doing with the podcast and everything. They were kind of looking at it from branding, and they got after me about my social media because I'm not on there that much. And they said that just looking at my Instagram, they're like, I would just assume you're like a nature photographer because it's just pictures of, like a canyon I used to hike and everything. So I'm not all that to say I'm not very good at selfies either. Well, Mary, thank you so much for your time. I appreciated the conversation and I appreciate the work that you've been doing. I think it's really important for our cultural moment to look into the shadow.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It's been a wonderful conversation.
And that's a wrap on episode 139 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're a part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family and on social media, and subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But the thing is, all of that is really important. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but with your support, I can speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here on the front range doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.